Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our webpage. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. Stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's rise to greatness, the first British and American empire in 1000 BC, when we come back. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 followed that scriptural principle when they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, it says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." Now, in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of these just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of using the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto and put that into our monetary system. They gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. And now in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson? If you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School. I conduct that twice a year here at the law school, but it's on compact disc if you want to do it at home for adult home education. And if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order the free general law tape first? That's the free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. The number to call to order that free general law CD package is 417-273-4967. Now, the Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org. Or call direct, it's 417-273-4967. All right, last time we finished the story of King David, tying together the secular and biblical historical events that show that ancient Israel, far from being made up of a bunch of Bedouins herding sheep across the desert, as is so often pictured by anthropologists and historians today, but in reality, they were confederated with the Tyre and Sidon Phoenician states and were the world's number one industrial, economic, military, and political power of that era, of that time. They obeyed God and kept his commandments under David and Solomon, and when they did, they became the wealthiest, most powerful nation on planet Earth. A group of tribes or nations, nation-states, confederated like the United States of America into a single federal government. The United States today is confederated in the same way that the 12 tribes of Israel were confederated under David. Now today we're split up and scattered around. You find the Danes in Denmark, Zebulun is in Holland, Reuben's in France, Ephraim in Great Britain, Manasseh in the United States, Asher in South Africa, and the guy who has identified these modern nations from the historical clues from both secular and biblical history is Stephen Collins. He lives up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Now, this is Solomon's golden age and the Empire of Israel. As Solomon became king, he could hardly have come to the throne under more favorable circumstances. The military power of his nation was unchallenged, and Israel's tribes were peaceful and prosperous, and in 1 Kings 4, verses 20 through 26, describes the political circumstances as follows. Judah and Israel were as many as the sand of the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all of the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and they served Solomon all the days of his life, because Solomon had dominion over all of the region west of the Euphrates from Tippish to Gaza, and he had peace on all sides round about him, and Judah and Israel dwelt in safety from Dan even to Beersheba. Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. Now, the tribes of Israel were numerous, prosperous, and secure from military threats. However, the listing of Judah and Israel as separate entities within Solomon's kingdom confirms that the tribes of Israel were still divided into these two groupings, even though they both acknowledged Solomon as their king. The area directly ruled by Solomon extended from the middle of Iraq, the Euphrates Valley, or the Euphrates River, to Egypt and the Nile Delta. Harper's Bible Dictionary comments that Tifsa is probably modern Dibsa on the west bank of the Euphrates River today. This would place Solomon's northern border in modern terms in the region of northern Syria. The statement that Solomon ruled all of the region west of the Euphrates confirms that the Syrian Aramean kings conquered by King David remained subordinate vassals to King Solomon. Since David had also conquered Syrians east of the Euphrates, as we read in 1 Chronicles 19, verses 16 through 19, King Solomon likely had Syrian vassals who ruled their own territory but paid tribute to Solomon east of the Euphrates River. Now, in the previous chapter, the Israelite role in the subjugation of Assyria during the reign of King David was revealed. The Mesopotamians stayed under Israel's domination during the reign of King Solomon as well. Secular history confirms that Assyria was not able to emerge from obscurity until after the death of King Solomon, when an Israelite civil war split Israel and Judah into warring nations and weakened their combined power. Now, the Bible also adds to that he had peace on all sides round about him. This attests to Assyria's weakness during Solomon's reign, that Assyria posed no military threat to Solomon, and in addition, there was likely an economic reason why Israel dominated Assyria. King Solomon's Israel controlled the critical overland trade routes between Africa, Asia, and Europe that met in the Middle East. Solomon was closely allied with the Phoenicians, who had a monopoly on maritime trade routes, and any nation hostile to Israel would have been excluded from the mercantile traffic of this ancient world monopoly. Therefore, Israel's peaceful prosperity during the reign of Solomon was based upon economic power as well as military strength. Now, the above passage stated that Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. The Bible indicates neither how many horses were allocated for each chariot, nor how many horses were accommodated in each stall. Therefore, it's impossible to calculate the number of Solomon's chariots. However, it is clear that his chariot force numbered in the thousands, and the 12,000 horsemen is not the total number of soldiers available to Solomon, as his father King David could muster 1,300,000 warriors when all of the reserves were mobilized, as we read in 2 Samuel 24, verse 9. These 12,000 horsemen were either Solomon's permanent cavalry force or a detachment of cavalry assigned to the charioteers. Solomon's initial acts were bloody acts. Acting on the advice of his dying father, King Solomon ordered the execution of Joab, the general of David's army. Solomon sent the head of David's Praetorian guard to carry out the order. And in 1 Kings 2, verses 28 through 35, Solomon also executed his half-brother Adonijah for daring to ask permission to marry a particular woman named Abishag. And in the final years of King David's reign, the nation of Israel held a national beauty contest in which Abishag was the winning female. Only young virgins could participate in the beauty contest, 1 Kings 1, verses 1 through 4. And unlike modern beauty contests today, where the winners receive scholarships and various gifts, the winner of ancient Israel's beauty contest was allowed to sleep with the king. However, David was very old and his interest in Abishag was strictly platonic. David never consummated a relationship with her. When Solomon replaced David, Abishag still belonged to whoever was king of Israel. In asking for Abishag, Adonijah was angling for a part of Solomon's royal privileges. Solomon properly saw his half-brother's request as an affront to his sovereignty, and he had Adonijah killed. And modern readers who are used to democracies and due process may have a hard time relating to the prerogatives of ancient kings. In ancient times, kings literally did have life and death authority over their subjects, and one had to be careful not to anger the king. Now, Solomon's wisdom was a divine favor that came from God himself. After Solomon removed the above initial threats to his authority, in 1 Kings 3, verses 5 through 14, it indicates that Solomon began his reign with a humble heart and a childlike desire to obey God and to keep his commandments. Now, God himself appeared to Solomon in a dream and said, "Ask what I shall give you." Most people would request wealth or power. Now, since Solomon was a king, he could conceivably have asked to rule the world through great conquests, and it is indicative of Solomon's excellent attitude that he asked the following. Solomon asked God, quote, "You have shown great and steadfast love to thy servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart toward you. And now, O Lord, my God, thou hast made your servant king in place of David, my father, and I do not know how to go out or come in. And thy servant is in the midst of thy people whom thou hast chosen, a great people that cannot be numbered or counted for multitude. Give thy servant, therefore, an understanding heart to govern thy people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this great people?" What an attitude! Conquests, wealth, and personal greatness were not priorities for Solomon. God was also pleased that Solomon had put the welfare of his subjects before personal aggrandizement, and he pronounced the following blessing on Solomon in verses 11 through 13. Here's God's answer to Solomon. God said to him, "Because you have asked this, and you have not asked for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemies, but you have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you, and none like you shall arise after you. I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all of your days." And so we shall see, God kept these promises to King Solomon in ways that our modern world has not appreciated or grasped up to this time. It is important at the outset of this chapter to point out that God promised to give Solomon an unprecedented gift of wisdom and to make Solomon the greatest king on the planet during his lifetime. Solomon received this awesome promise because of his humble attitude. Solomon's legendary wisdom was a direct gift from God, not a result of favorable genetics. God's reaction to Solomon's request was consistent with God's New Testament instruction in Matthew 6, verse 33, that people should seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. And then all of these things, that's the material blessing, shall be added unto you. Solomon made righteousness his top priority, and God added material blessings to him as well. This illustration is an example of the continuity of God's responses to mankind in both Old and New Testaments. So with this introduction, let us examine how God fulfilled this promise to Solomon, and what happened to Solomon after he received these gifts. Now, faced with no military threats, Solomon turned the boundless wealth of his nation into financing peacetime pursuits. His principal project was the construction of the temple for God, for which David had stockpiled immense materials. This was such a vast project that it took 7 years to build the temple, as we read in 1 Kings 6, verses 37 and 38. Now, as soon as King Hiram of Tyre heard that David was dead, he quickly sent ambassadors to Solomon to ensure that he stayed in the good graces of Israel's new ruler. We see that in 1 Kings 5, verse 1. Solomon was eager to continue this close relationship between Israel and the city-states of Tyre and Sidon. The fact that Hiram initiated this action to stay in favorable relations with Israel confirms that Israel's power was superior to that of the Phoenician states of Tyre and Sidon. A lesser power will typically seek favor with a greater power to protect its own self-interests. Now, King Solomon and Hiram pooled their national resources on the temple construction project for which David had stockpiled so many of the materials. The temple construction project led to very close cooperation between Israel and the Phoenician city-states as armies of workmen from each country worked in the other country's territory. This project was so large that in 1 Kings 5, verses 2 through 18, recorded Solomon had 30,000 workers from Israel's territory working in three monthly shifts in Phoenician territory. And it also adds that 150,000 conscripts worked as laborers under 3,300 Israelite officers. That's 2 Chronicles 8, verses 7 through 9, which tells us that these conscripts were non-Israelites, and adds that Solomon did not conscript Israelites as involuntary workers. Now, the above manpower allocations indicate that the small Phoenician city-states of Tyre and Sidon had no major reserves of manpower to devote to such a large project as the building of the temple of God. Solomon had to send thousands of men into Phoenicia in order to have sufficient workers to cut the timber required for the project. The small population of the Phoenician city-states and the much larger population of Israel will become an important factor when we later examine the scope and nature of this Phoenician empire. The temple project forged a very close alliance between Israel's tribes and the Phoenician city-states. Armies of Israelites and Phoenicians worked on each other's territories, as we see in 1 Kings 5, verses 6 through 18, and large rafts were built to float many cedar timbers to Israel by way of the Mediterranean Sea. And artisans from Phoenicia worked with the Israelites at the temple site in Jerusalem. This ability to easily integrate the labor forces of both nations confirms that there were very minimal linguistic and cultural differences between the Israelites and the Phoenicians. Now, while the temple itself was the focal point of this mutual construction effort, many auxiliary buildings, such as treasury buildings and granaries for the Levites, livestock holding pens for sacrificial offerings, residential areas for the priests, were all needed to support these temple activities. The temple project took 7 years to complete, And then this joint Israelite-Phoenician labor force worked another 13 years to complete Solomon's personal palace, as we see in 1 Kings 7, verses 1 and 2. And in 2 Chronicles 8, verse 1, 2 Chronicles 8, verse 2 records that King Hiram ceded Phoenician territory to King Solomon, who settled Israelites in it. And the permanent settlement of Israelites in Phoenicia further promoted the intermingling of the Israelites and Phoenicians. Intermarriage between the two groups was common, and in 1 Kings 7, verses 13 and 14, it mentions that one particularly crafted and skilled craftsman had an Israelite mother and a Phoenician father. And also built were storage cities, military facilities, and walled cities throughout Israel and its extended domain. And Solomon even built a separate palace for his wife, who was a daughter of Egypt's Pharaoh, as we see in 1 Kings 7, verses 1 through 12, and 2 Chronicles 8, verses 1 through 6. Now, since the tribes of Israel and the Phoenician city-states worked together for decades on Solomon's immense building projects, these projects united the Israelites and Phoenicians into a single demographic entity. Cultural and linguistic differences would have become almost non-existent as they lived, worked, and played in close association with one another for over 20 years. And while certain differences in culture and dialect would remain, members of other nations would have had increased difficulty in distinguishing between these two peoples, and this will be an important factor when we examine the secular records about the identity of the Phoenicians. Solomon had other interests beside building projects, and in 1 Kings 4, verses 29 through 33, it records that God gave Solomon great wisdom and understanding and a mind with broad interests. His wisdom excelled that of any of the wise men of the East, including those of Egypt, and he was famous among all of the surrounding nations. He was the author of 3,000 proverbs and wrote 1,000 songs. He was a great naturalist with interest in animals, birds, snakes, fishes, and trees. And from the great cedars of Lebanon to the tiny hyssop that grows in the cracks in the wall, and kings from many lands sent their ambassadors to Solomon for his advice. Now Solomon, the recipient of all of this divine wisdom, excelled in many fields. He was a ruler, he was a builder, he was an author, a songwriter, and a naturalist, and he studied all forms of flora and fauna. The arts flourished under Solomon. He built gardens. He had all manner of gold and silver treasures from many, many nations, from all parts of the world. He acted as a patron for the best singers and musicians that he could find. And we read that in Ecclesiastes 2, verses 4 through 10. Solomon was so rich, and he had so much free time, that he literally could afford to do it all. His insatiable scientific curiosity led him to collect treasures, artworks, singers, musicians, plants, and animals. The zoos, the museums, and the cultural activities during Solomon's reign must have been incredible. It was truly the golden age of the kingdom of Israel. Now, the Living Bible account captures in modern terms the fact that Solomon became a scientific naturalist with an interest in studying, collecting, and cataloging all forms of animal and plant life. However, it has a shortcoming. The King James and Revised Standard Version of the Bible state in verse 31 that Solomon was wiser than all men and all other men respectively. They also state that Solomon was visited by representative of all of the kings of the earth. The Living Bible minimizes the description of Solomon's preeminent wisdom and worldwide fame, perhaps reflecting a modern apologist approach toward the Bible's claims. When we examine evidence from secular accounts, we shall see that the Bible did not exaggerate its accounts in Solomon's reign. Now, King Solomon's global Phoenician empire looked like this. Projects as vast in scope as Solomon could not go unnoticed in either the Middle East or the more distant nations of the earth. It is small wonder, then, that Solomon's fame spread rapidly around the world. He was in close alliance with the Phoenician city-states, whose maritime fleets carried news of Solomon's projects and of Solomon's activities wherever they sailed. Even as the Israelite and the Phoenician populations were joined on land due to the vast building projects of Solomon, they also coalesced into a single unit in the Phoenician fleets, as we see in 1 Kings 9, verses 26 and 27, where it says, quote, King Solomon built a fleet of ships in Ezion-Gabur, which is near Elioth on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom, E-D-O-M, Edom. And Hiram sent with the fleet his servants, seamen, who were familiar with the sea, together with the servants of Solomon. Now, Solomon was not content to be a land power alone. Solomon wanted to make Israel a major maritime force in the world as well. This fleet was based on the Red Sea near Ezion-Gabur, the precise location of the large ore-smelting facility described in Chapter 1. Naturally, in order to import the ores in sufficient quantity to keep the blast furnaces operating, it made sense to base a large fleet at the site of the industrial activity. It is possible that Solomon's fleet sailed around Africa's Cape of Good Hope to reach the Atlantic Ocean and the copper mines of North America described in the previous chapter. However, there is a more likely alternative. Modern mankind hailed the construction of the Suez Canal as a major engineering achievement, and indeed it was. However, ancient civilizations also linked the Mediterranean and the Red Seas by way of a water route, and on several occasions, Sesostris III of ancient Egypt is credited with connecting the Nile River with the Red Sea, creating a sea route between the Mediterranean and the Red Seas, and the ancient Persian emperor Darius the Great in the year 521 through 486 BC is credited with building a Nile-Red Sea waterway, anticipating the Suez Canal. The ancient Egyptian waterway has been dated to approximately 1380 BC, and indeed the Encyclopedia Britannica states that the channel of this canal is still traceable to this day, and its direction was frequently followed by the engineers of the freshwater canal, that is, the modern canal. And further efforts to reopen or maintain this ancient waterway are attributed to Ptolemy Philadelphus of Egypt in the 3rd century BC, the Roman Emperor Trajan, 98 AD, and Muslim rulers of Egypt in the 7th century AD. And since the Egyptians had already established a sea link from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea before the rule of King Solomon, Solomon's Israelite fleet could easily have utilized the Egyptian waterway to link Ezion-Gabur with the Mediterranean Sea, and from there, the Atlantic Ocean. Now, King Hiram's Phoenicians sailed with the Israelites, teaching them maritime navigational skills, and the Israelite Navy shared all of the seafaring skills of the Phoenician Navy, since 2 Chronicles 9, verse 21 records that the Phoenicians and the Israelites jointly served in the same naval fleets. The Phoenician Navy became a joint venture between the Israelites and the city-states of Tyre and Sidon. Solomon's Red Sea fleet could, of course, easily trade with Africa and Asia by way of the Indian Ocean. As the Israelites and Phoenicians joined forces on both land and sea, they became a confederated empire under Solomon's overall leadership. Well, let's take a break right here. Let me give you our mid-break reminder, and we'll be back with more on King Solomon's Golden Age and Israel's Empire. Israel's rise to greatness in the first British American Empire, 1000 B.C. Now, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the school direct at 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, or they're religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review, or vice versa. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Remember that for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, just go to the website georgegordon.org or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a book by Stephen Collins. And Collins wrote the book, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. That's the title of the book. It's about Israel's rise to greatness in the first British and American empire, which was established by David in 1000 B.C. The author's name, again, Stephen Collins, published by Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. Again, that's Bible Blessings is the publisher, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. Or go to their website, www.BibleBlessings.net. Again, www.BibleBlessings.net. These books are what I call 1 in 100 books. I'm looking at 4 here. Let me give you the titles. Israel's Lost Empires is 1. The Lost 10 Tribes of Israel Found is 2. Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower and Its Role in Biblical History is 3. I'm looking at book number 4, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. And I don't know what happened to book number 5. I got 5 in from Stephen Collins here some months back. I called him and I said, hey, I'd like to update my library. Give me all of your books. I sent him a $100 bill for the 5 books. I'm assuming they're about $20 each. And he'll autograph them for you. Let me give you his phone number. Call the guy, Stephen Collins. Tell him that George, little Georgie, sent you, and that you'd like him to autograph these books. The number is 605-361-5069. That's area code 605-361-5069. and we are reviewing this book, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. And remember, this is strong meat. Most Christians can't handle this kind of strong meat, and of course evolutionists and atheists are out in left field. But there are a few, probably 7,000 here in Israel, that haven't bowed their knee to Baal that can probably handle this kind of historical information. All of his books are immaculately researched out. I say immaculate. Let me use the word diligently researched out. The bibliographies in here are a who's who of what goes on in the ancient world, both secular and scriptural. Collins has a good grasp of the scripture, and he has a good grasp of history. And I wanted to point out that he has a number of references in here, I think, to In Plain Sight and Barry Fell's books on America BC. And I noticed in here that he cited a number of other Barry Fell books. Now, these two members of the Epigraphic Society, Barry Fell and Gloria Farley, who wrote America BC and In Plain Sight, have uncovered literally hundreds of sites in America, in places like New Hampshire, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Colorado, Michigan, and New Mexico, that we know of, where these Phoenician and Israelites have sites written in stone. Now, you didn't hear that, you know, from your local college professor or archaeology and review or archaeological review. They don't talk about this. You're not supposed to know this. Columbus discovered America, and that's all you need to know. Sit down, shut up, ride the back of the bus, and do what you're told. These series of books, or this series of books, is so unique that I have branded it a 1 in 100 read. You will never read another book like these Collins books. That's how impressed I was. All right, now we're talking about Solomon. So before examining where this joint Phoenician-Israelite navy sailed, another important event of that time should be mentioned, and that's Egypt's pharaoh. Egypt's pharaoh joined this Israelite-Phoenician alliance, making it even more of a superpower in the ancient world. We read that in 1 Kings 3, verse 1, and it notes that one of Solomon's first wives was a daughter of the Egyptian pharaoh. Now, marriages among the royalty of ancient nations was a standard means of cementing an alliance. 1 Kings 9, verse 16 adds that Pharaoh sent his army to conquer a city and present that city to Solomon as a dowry for his daughter's marriage to Solomon. Solomon, the tireless builder, rebuilt the city all over again in 1 Kings 9, verse 17, and with Solomon in a close alliance with King Hiram of Tyre and with Egypt's pharaoh, now Solomon's father-in-law, Israel, Phoenicia, and Egypt became a triple alliance under Solomon's leadership. And this alliance made sense because Egypt was a traditional rival of the Mesopotamian powers of Assyria and Babylon, and Israel had defeated both of them. Also, the Egyptians and the Phoenicians enjoyed friendly relations, making this a natural alliance among these three powers. Egypt contributed additional maritime strength, and they utilized descendants of the sea peoples who settled in ancient Libya as their sailors. And an earlier chapter of this book documented that many of the sea peoples were Israelites from the tribe of Dan and other tribes of Israel. During Solomon's time, the raiding of the sea peoples came to an end, and Lionel Cashin's book, Ancient Mariners, Seafarers, and Seafighters of the Mediterranean in Ancient Times, gives us this insight. Quote, "The years around 1200 BC mark a critical period in the history of the eastern Mediterranean. On the seas, lawlessness prevailed. Conditions on the sea started to improve about 1000 BC, and the merchants once again were willing to send goods to destinations over the oceans. Now, an earlier chapter documented that the Danites were a major part of the marauding sea peoples in 1200 BC, the same time that Judges 5, verse 17 confirms that many Danites had a maritime lifestyle. And the fact that the sea peoples ceased their raiding during the reigns of Kings David and Solomon about 1000 BC was due to two factors. First, many of these sea people had a natural affinity for the Phoenician alliance because of their Israelite origin. And two, the naval alliance of Israel, Tyre, Sidon, and Egypt represented a superior maritime power which could stop their raiding. So many of the sea peoples merged their naval forces into the alliance of Israel, Phoenicia, and Egypt, further strengthening Solomon's empire worldwide. Now, having established that Israel, Phoenicia, and Egypt comprised a joint alliance under Solomon's direction, we can now examine where the fleets of these nations sailed, what countries, what continents they explored, and where did they colonize during Solomon's peaceful reign. And as we shall see, Solomon's rule likely constituted the greatest golden age in the ancient world. Historians have long known that the Phoenicians traded and colonized throughout the Mediterranean Sea as well as into the Atlantic Ocean to Western Europe and ancient British Isles. Historian George Rawlinson wrote of these facts in his book Phoenicia in 1676. Another historian, Islet Sams, wrote the following about the Phoenician presence in the British Isles. Quote, "And from these Phoenicians are the first antiquities of this nation to be derived upon the account that their voyages hither may be proved by the authority of the best authors. Their language is sufficiently known, being a dialect of Hebrew. The Phoenicians traded hither. From hence may be gathered the name of Britain itself." Now, this account confirms that the Phoenician presence in the British Isles was known long before the 17th century. Mr. Sams wrote about this fact in 1676, and he cites earlier authors as the authority for his statement. Sams also acknowledges that the Phoenician language was a dialect of the Hebrew language, and that the name Britain was given to the British Isles by the Phoenicians. Now, this is a very important point, because the Israelites dominated the Phoenician alliance, and the Israelites were the covenant people. And the Hebrew word for covenant has the consonants B-R-T. So it is evident that the name Britain preserves to this day the role of the Israelite covenant and the covenant people in the early colonization and the naming of the British Isles. Now, another account records that the Phoenician fleets also visited ancient Ireland. In his 1869 book, The History of Ireland, John Mitchell wrote, quote, "We know that the Phoenicians were masters of almost all of the nations of Europe. They sailed, said Newton, in the times of David and Solomon upon the Mediterranean Sea as far as Spain and beyond it. They introduced everywhere the sciences, particularly navigation, astronomy, and letters. And the coasts of Ireland," says Ware, after Bocart, "were known to them." Now, this 19th century historian cites many previous writers as his authorities, and it is noteworthy that this account specifically says that it was during the reigns of Kings David and Solomon that the Phoenicians sailed beyond the Mediterranean Sea to ancient Ireland. Now, the Golden Age of Phoenician exploration coincided with the Golden Age of King Solomon's time, when the Israelites sent fleets to other continents that took 3 years to return. We read that in 1 Kings 10, verse 22. Solomon's Golden Age was characterized by his intense scientific interest in botany, zoology, the arts, and exploration of foreign lands. The above account notes that the Phoenicians of David and Solomon's time brought not armies of conquerors, but scientists and scientific knowledge to many new lands around the world. And this perfectly coincides with the biblical accounts that King Solomon's alliance with the Phoenicians was a time of exploration and scientific pursuit. The biblical golden age of King Solomon and golden age of the Phoenicians, recorded by secular historians, were one and the same, and this point will become ever clearer in the remainder of this chapter. It has now been confirmed that Phoenician voyages and colonization efforts extended to the New World. The remarkable discoveries of an extensive Phoenician presence in the New World were detailed by the late Dr. Barry Fell in his books America B.C. and Saga America. And while this book will cite pertinent portions of Dr. Fell's books, readers are referred to Dr. Fell's books for additional information on this subject. Dr. Fell was a professor emeritus of Harvard University, an internationally renowned expert on ancient languages, and the founder of the National Epigraphic Society. Now, Dr. Fell cited evidence that the Phoenicians had a regular port of call off the coast of Maine, where an ancient inscription was found which was coeval, that is, contemporaneous with Phoenician inscriptions, and translated as ships of Phoenicia, cargo, platform. And Dr. Fell added, quote, "It is obvious that the flat-topped rocky islet would not have been set aside for the loading and unloading of Phoenician ships were they not regular visitors to America with a predictable timetable of ports of arrival and departure at expected dates. These inscriptions, therefore, suggest that organized international maritime commerce was well established in the late Bronze Age, and that North American ports were listed on the sailing timetables of the overseas vessels of the principal Phoenician shipping companies, and that the same information was circulated to customers in America." Now, the previous chapter noted evidence that the Phoenicians shipped copper ore from the Lake Superior region to ancient Israel during the reigns of Kings David and Solomon. It is logical that the Phoenicians would establish colonies and seaports in the New World to support their international commerce. Evidence of the Phoenician presence has been found in New England and many parts of America. A large temple observatory site was found at Mystery Hill in North Salem, New Hampshire. This site covered approximately 20 acres and included shrines with dedications to the Phoenician Canaanite god Baal. Now, a 20-acre site confirms that the Phoenicians had a major presence in the New World. Dr. Fell dated inscriptions at this temple of Baal to approximately 800 to 600 BC, although radiocarbon dating of charcoal samples from this site show it was inhabited back to the 2nd millennium BC, and pictures of this site are found in Chapter 5 of this book. I might pause right here and point out that pictures of these sites, of which they number in the hundreds, Collins is going to identify and mention probably 10 or 15 in this book. In the book written by Gloria Farley, In Plain Sight, she has the pictures of literally hundreds of inscriptions all over the western United States. I should say Midwestern United States. Because these ancient mariners sailed up the Mississippi River. They went up the Arkansas River. They went up the Ohio River. There were colonies in West Virginia, And Phoenician coins, along with Roman coins, have been found all over Midwestern and Eastern United States sites. These finds are never reported in mainstream press or in archaeological review or in college or university transcripts and publications. I've never seen a one anywhere. Now, I talked to Gloria Farley personally. Dr. Barry Fell is dead now. I have talked personally with Stephen Collins. These people have physically seen these sites. I went to Oklahoma. It's called Heavenly Oklahoma, and I physically looked at one of these ancient sites from these ancient Israelite and Phoenicians. It's about 3 or 4 hours drive from Isabella, Missouri, over to Heavenly or Heavenly or Heavenly Oklahoma, where Gloria Farley lives. And she took us out there to that site that they had discovered. It is now a state park, and the state of Oklahoma maintains it. And you can go to it, and it's recorded in her book. Now, that's one that I've seen. And there are literally, now when I say hundreds, I mean, I'm telling you, boys and girls, hundreds of these sites all over the United States. Now, surely, the universities and colleges and anthropologists and archaeologists and all the rest of these paid professionals with all of the letters behind their names know about these sites, have seen these sites, and marvel over, how do we explain them away? And that's because the official politically correct interpretation of ancient history is that man dragging his knuckles on the ground walked across a land bridge from Siberia to Alaska. Now that's the official politically correct ancient history. And it's just plain BS. Just so much BS. Bovine, you know what. All right, going on. The ships of Tarshish referred to in Ezekiel 27, verse 25, and Jonah 1, verse 3, made voyages to the New World. And inscriptions and tablets of their involvement in colonization and colonizing ancient America was preserved in Rhode Island, Ohio, and West Virginia. This identification is dependent upon Tarshish being the name, or the same as ancient Tartessus, that's Tartessus, on the Iberian Peninsula of ancient Europe. And Barry Fell notes that this Tartessian inscription in ancient America are dialectal variants of Phoenician, confirming that these early American visitors were also Semites from the Mediterranean area. Fell's evidence is impressive. His book compares nearly identical Phoenician figurines with their characteristic high-crowned hat and hennin. One Phoenician figurine was from Cyprus. The other was found in a burial site of the mound builders of ancient America. Now, these mounds are all over the Middle West. I mean, these are called mounds, and there are hundreds of them. Then there are these big mounds. I mean, they're built like pyramids over here on the Mississippi River. My wife had told me about these, and she said, you know, you've got to see these mounds. I mean, they're like the Great Pyramids. And I said, well, I've heard about these mounds, you know, I've seen the pyramids of the sun and the moon down in Mexico City, or outside Mexico, about 40 miles. And so she took me over there. They're all state parks. They're over in Illinois. And I'm telling you, boys and girls, this mound is 400 feet high. Now, did you hear that? It's 400 feet high, and the top of it is built out of dirt, not built out of rock like, you know, the Great Pyramids of Egypt. It's built out of dirt, just plain dirt. 400 feet high, and on the top of it, it has a flat spot 1/2 acre in size. I walked up to the top of it, and I took a look at that. Now, 1/2 acre is a pretty good piece of real estate. to be sticking up in the air 400 feet out in the plains of Illinois. And I think there's 9 of those. I haven't seen them all, but I've seen the dots on the maps, you know, that the Park Service puts out. I saw one of them. Well, those mounds were built by these pyramid builders, these Israelites. The ancient Israelites, when they were in captivity in Egypt, built those pyramids, or many of them. They came over to the Americas and with those designs in mind, built those pyramids called the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Moons down in Mexico. Now take a look at these big stone pyramids that you see in the Mayas and the Aztecs and so on, and they're patterned right after the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians. Those people had contact with people in the Middle East and Europe. The Indians of North America and South America had contact with Europeans and Middle Easterners clear back in B.C. times. Boys and girls, believe it or not. And the evidence is right here in these books by Stephen Collins. And I'm telling you that Barry Fell did a great job, and Gloria Farley, and these authors, these secular historians like Rawlinson and so on, they've all done, you know, their little piece of the puzzle. But it's this guy, Collins, that has put all of the puzzle together. You know, it's kind of like a lot of people have made the pieces to the puzzle and identified the pieces to the puzzle and told you where these pieces of the puzzle came from. Barry Fell says, hey, this is Phoenician. This is Phoenician language. This is Phoenician coin. This is Phoenician in Maine. Phoenician in West Virginia and Ohio. Well, who were these Phoenicians tied in with? The ancient Israelites. The Egyptians. And you know, there are Egyptian writing down there in the Mayan, and this has always been a real bugaboo to archaeologists. They go down here to the Yucatan Peninsula and take a look at the Mayas and these various Indians down there, and they read Egyptian hieroglyphs. And they say, oh, we don't understand. This is a real mystery as to how Egyptian hieroglyphs could be on these monuments down here in the Yucatan Peninsula. Come on, you boys. It's time for you to grow up and get real. That's what the bottom line is. So let me tell you a little more here about this guy, Stephen Collins, and I'm going to put an arrow right here on page 204. We'll take it up right here next time. I got a couple of minutes, so let me tell you about a way for you to get a hold of these books. This is called Bible Blessings. That's the publishing company. Bible Blessings, www.BibleBlessings.net. They got a web page. Or you can write to them at Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. That's the full zip code. That's Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. Now, if you'd like to have an autographed copy, I'm going to not clear this with Mr. Collins, but I'm going to assume that he'd like it if I promoted his books. And I am promoting his books. I don't do that very often, but when I see a product or something that is so outstanding, his number is 605-361-5069. Jot that down. It's area code 605-361-5069. Guy's name is Stephen Collins. Tell him little Georgie sent you. Autograph the book. Would you please? All right, time's about up, so let me give you a reminder that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Okay, my time is up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and good night, friends.